Board or reconvene the hearing.
Just very quickly before Mr. Olsen gives the evidence, I've got to attempt to get a little bit of evidence myself, but I can give it in, and it may not be particularly relevant, but I can give an affidavit for a witness. Mr. Spear mentioned yesterday a discussion about lighting, and he was just mentioned last night that in terms of gondola carriages, the lighting is LED under the seat, and it's dim so that you can still see the view. Now, I can get him to confirm that. I don't know if that's any great moment, but it was something he mentioned that post-hearing. I can get him to confirm that in writing, or I can recall him in the next couple of days if he wanted to explore cabin lighting with him. I just want to mention that. Leave that with you, and if you want to. I know I'm breaking the rules, so I don't want to be in on him to do that. But
you can see some of the other councils. That's helpful anyway, because I think that was one of the purposes of the question. We don't need an affidavit.
No, and just in terms of that, talking with Mr. Spear after the hearing, if other things come in terms of that design, he's here for the next 3 days. He can always come back and answer any further questions that he has. So I'll get the summary story, sir. That's for you.
Subject property can be accessed by two existing farm roads. One is the property by Charter Farm to the east, and the other from Ford Road to the east. The initial concept designs along the various alignments have indicated that creating a road corridor through land from Ford Road to the west to boundary would be reasonably straightforward. The preliminary concept road models show that it will be possible to extend a 6 metre wide rural corridor along the existing farm road alignment. There is, however, some areas along the alignment that have width constraints due to topography. To overcome these areas, the width of the corridor could be narrowed, or localised sections or the road bench widened by cutting or filling either side of the existing road bench. The council did not comment specifically on road geometry. Section 2, water supply. The subject property is surrounded by potential water sources. The Carrier River adjoins the property to the north, while two large stormwater catchments cover a large majority of the face of the remarkables to the south and feed fresh water into the Rastaswim and Owens Creek watercourses. It is envisaged that a self-contained water supply and interconnected system for the proposed development areas could be established on the property in a number of ways which could draw directly from any of the sources above. Council's reporting officer agreed that a self-contained water supply was achievable. Section 3, wastewater. It is envisaged that the wastewater disposal systems for the site could be self-contained. Preliminary ground investigations have shown that good ground conditions are available and suitable for disposal to ground systems. Initial estimations of wastewater production and site design infiltration rates have indicated that the areas required to be set aside for wastewater disposal needs are obtainable. Council's reporting officer agreed that self-contained wastewater systems was achievable. Section 4, stormwater. Existing stormwater from the property drains to the watercourses traversing the site and ultimately to the Carrier River. Any proposed areas of development will drain stormwater from the property in a similar fashion. However, the quality and quantity of the discharge will change due to the introduction of the previous areas, and this needs to be addressed. In order to prevent the concentration of runoff, it is expected that the provision of the stormwater drainage for the site will necessarily involve usage of low impact design principles. Council's reporting officer agreed that a self-contained stormwater system was achievable. Section 5, conclusions. Road to access the site can be upgraded to appropriate standards. Numerous suitable water supplies for the site are available and feasible to extract from. Wastewater treatment and disposal to the ground in the proposed area of the development is achievable. Stormwater can be managed using low impact design principles on the site.
Thank you, Mr. Robson, please answer your questions.
I need to understand a few things.
Okay.
a fact checking thing.
Yeah.
On road geometry, you say at paragraph 1.2 of your summary that you're talking about a 6 metre wide rural road corridor, but in your EIC, at paragraph 5.7, you have a narrower one, 5.5 to 5.7 metres. Okay. Is that a material difference?
Under the QRDC code of practice, they are for the category of the road, they want it sealed with 5.5 to 5.7, and then you have a half metre shoulder on each side. And so we, and then that gets you to 6 metres. So
6.5.
So we ran along, we ran a 3-metre corridor model along at the 6 metre with batters on each side to get a feel for what sort of cut and fill batters were required on the line.
So that doesn't change your conclusion about filling the road. It's not material. Okay, that's good. On the subject of water supply, there are three options. Is any one option more likely?
I think the sourcing water from the Owens Creek catchment is probably a better option, and the reason for that would be that the Rastus Spring catchment has the NZ Ski wastewater disposal ponds at the head of the Rastus Spring Creek, so it's probably not a good idea to extract drinking water from there. And by doing it at Owens catchment, you could inset water higher up the mountain, and then that would give you pressure head to reticulate the water through any development, whereas if you extract it next to, or down lower next to the river, you've got to use energy to drive your pumps, and then you pump it up the hill to a storage reservoir on the hill, and then that trickle back down.
Would you still
have
a reservoir on the hill with the water creek, or would...
You need some reservoir volume for fire storage, and then you could have just a trickle system of holding tanks of each development and booster pumps that way, or you could have more reservoirs on the hill, depending on the hill somewhere.
And that was going to be my other question. I was looking at your evidence at Chief at 6.4, and you're talking about reservoirs connected to Owen Creek and the proposed areas of development. How many reservoirs would you have on? Is there one per pod, or how would it work? I'm thinking of landscape effects in the end.
Yeah, so I guess it's pretty early days, but yeah, it would be dictated by a fire bombing. The amount of development and the fire requirements, so I couldn't really say if it's all right at the moment. The other thing with fire as well, you've got the option of putting the reservoirs there, or what QRDC are currently doing at the moment is putting in, because you've got double the cost, because you've got to have a reservoir on the hill and then pump up to it, and you have a big reservoir for fire, whereas QRDC have gone away from that and may like to, a cheaper cost is to have basically an extraction well to a river source and then a booster pump on sort of constant waiting, so if there was a fire outbreak that booster pump actually injects water into the reticulation system quite quickly.
See, we don't know. It'll all be sorted out. I did have a question about stormwater, particularly for RV3, and I just want to understand. There's the calculation of the amount of stormwater, which I guess isn't all that important to me, except that it says there's 3.3 hectares of disposal beds needed for the building footprint. And is it the building footprint that dictates the amount of waste generated, or is it the use of the building?
It's the use of the building, so sort of general rule is that a person might use 200 litres a day in water and for a residential type house, and then as a combination of the use and the number of people, and then the amount or the rate at which the ground can absorb that water. So basically, the soils are about the best you can get because they're sand grout pools, and so they have quite a high absorption rate. So effectively you take the amount of people based on the use and times it by a chosen value, like 200 litres a day per person, and then you divide it by the soakage rate, and that gives you the area of soakage beds.
Okay, so for me, what I'm not clear about is the kind of development that will eventually happen at RV3. There are a number of possibilities. So, but what you're saying is that given it's really good soils and that there's plenty of land, there's a probability that whatever development happens, something can be designed that would work?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just on that point, while it's very good soakage, what nitrogen amelioration options are available?
So I guess we've got the RRC rules that most would use a treatment plant to comply with those, and then you also got chemical additives and those sorts of things that you can add to a treatment plant to reduce the nitrogen even more. So for example, the Glendoo camping ground in Wanaka, its treatment plant is one of the worst in the located. Mm. The disposal area is one of the worst in the district, so it has an additional, I think they call it glucosamate or something. It's like a byproduct of a biochemical of biofuel industry that they can actually inject into the wastewater, and that can pretty much neutralise any nitrogen.
Just on the stormwater, you said that low impact design principles. Is that a no increase in the amount of stormwater leaving the property, or is it just we'll reduce it before it gets to the big pipe?
I guess modern design is attenuation and quality are the two concerns with stormwater. So
what I'm thinking is, you're familiar with the Kurimoka? That one is a no
increase.
A no increase in water leaving.
Yeah.
But that's actually more than LID, isn't it? Because people use LID, but they don't mean that.
Yeah, well, I guess in my opinion, LID is both. It's just controlling the quantity of stormwater and the quality.
Yeah.
So obviously, when you pave a whole area, you get a faster runoff of stormwater.
Mm.
And having, I came to Queenstown sort of 7 years ago, and down here is a little bit backwards as far as stormwater quality and attenuation goes. Compared to Auckland, so things that I was practicing in Auckland, say in the early 2000s, are only coming into being used in Queenstown now. So I guess with Remarkables Park, we've always done that work for us 20 or 30 years, Queenstown Station. So we've always pushed them in the direction that these are best practices for controlling stormwater and wastewater.
Right.
So you look to, and really the attenuation part of the low impact comes from preventing scouring of creeks, in Auckland it was a lot of sensitive urban creeks and stuff, whereas potentially down here it's not as great a concern because you have the snow melt that would be flushing a big scouring water flow down a water course and then if you urbanised it, you could potentially argue, well, when we had the snow melt before, we had this big scour thing, but the best one would be to look at post-development flows versus pre-development and try to equalise them so the receiving environment was receiving the same flows that it was previous to development.
The question I had, it wasn't clear from my question was to see this day as soon as the electricity distribution, and it's not clear in the report. Is it overground or underground proposed for throughout the whole system?
I can only comment on what I know of the discussions that have been occurring. So I know that NZ Ski are currently looking at upgrading the system, and there's a section of line that they privately own from about halfway along the access road.
Yes.
And so they're talking to...
Is that from where the Delta transformer is?
Yes, correct. So, I guess there's discussions underway between Electricity South and being a provider to upgrade the private section of mine and with Aurora. So, Electricity South and all of the network within the Queenstown district is underground, and it's the newer and more reliable network, so...
I understand that difference between the utility section.
So I think they're probably in the box seat, and they've indicated in various discussions that they would continue their practice of trying underground.
So essentially, if it's pounding, that would be underground. That's what you're saying.
I just want to say that's just to protect Mr. Ross in terms of the evidence.
Yeah, that's not his choice.
That's what we understand, but those are discussions in scale. We only know what we hear. Just be careful, we're not giving representation.
No, I understand.
But that looks,
But there is, clearly the lift system itself needs electricity at the top.
Yes, and Mr. Porter could perhaps speak to this, but they understand what the arrangement is, they can tap into that supply that's going to be in scheme. In terms of development, RV and RR, that would all be underground. Power supply.
Right.
I know we
focused,
the question was on the gondola, but just to clarify.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. Thank you, Mr.
Wilson.
Thank you very
much. Thank you, sir. I've got Mr. Johnson.
Work experience in surveying, aerial mapping, computer programming and visualisation, and my qualifications set up evidence and chief dated 9th of June 2017. The visual simulations created by Build Media were prepared using the best survey and visualisation practices and involved a series of processes and steps to ensure consistency and accuracy in the development of each image. Build Media followed the NZILA best practice guide as a method of producing visual simulations. And a series of photographs were taken for viewpoints 1 to 4 and 7 to 8 on the 5th and 6th of March 2016 using a Canon EOS 50D digital camera with a 53mm lens and using a tripod. Viewpoint 5 and 6 were captured on the 25th of April 2017 using a Canon EOS 60D digital camera with a 50mm lens and using a tripod. photographs were captured every 5 degrees using a specialist robotic camera head to remove parallax error. Camera positions were captured by APEX surveying and used to determine the virtual camera placement. APEX surveying captured tie points were accessible. The 3D tie point position indicators were added into the 3D scene at the actual position. The virtual camera was then altered in direction so that the tie points matched the features in the rectilinear image. Multiple tie points were used across the whole width of the view to ensure consistent accuracy. They were then rendered and overlaid onto the existing panorama. For panoramas where no tie points were captured, contour data was generated from remote part LiDAR data and used to align the photography. The gondola towers are modeled using planes and elevations supplied by Lea Poma. Height, inclination, and position were modeled for each tower. The gondola cabins are spaced as per the specifications in the cross sections. The gondola towers and cabins were coloured half iron sand. The upper gondola station 3 model supplied by ERIS Consultants Limited and imported into the overall 3D model. This was also coloured half iron sand. The lower stations are modeled using Lea Poma's cross-sections and architectural designs supplied by Remarks Park Limited. The stations are coloured half iron sand. In the 3D model, the sun and environment are simulated at the precise day and time each photograph is captured. This ensures the lighting of the gondola as well as the shadows cast that are accurately represented of how the gondola would appear in the photography. 2D imaging editing software was used to quickly edit what would normally appear in the foreground of the image. Foreground features are transcribed out of the original photograph and placed into their exact position in front of the 3D object. Both rectilinear and cylindrical image projections are supplied in the final visual simulation layouts. Conclusion of the media is the best evangelizing practice and involves a series of processes and steps to ensure accuracy in the development of each visual simulation. These visual simulations accurately represent the proportions locations of the gondola and views and the selected locations describe the design dimension process.
A general question about your methodology.
Yeah.
You've done exercises like this before, obviously.
Yes, quite.
Have you been back to completed projects and sort of rerun the exercise to check that you're to verify the results you're getting?
Yes, we've done that for a project for Bunnings, which was in Auckland City. We revisited the site afterwards to take photography. They had changed the architectural design of the building slightly in terms of its position and location.
But the images were comparable.
Sorry?
The images were pretty comparable. Have you done that exercise for a site as big as this one?
Not for
the site. I'm particularly thinking of the distances involved from some of those viewpoints.
No, we haven't revisited a site to check. We have worked on a number of wind farm projects, which would be, I would say, size-wise, be very similar, if not bigger. However, they weren't built, so we haven't had the opportunity to revisit them and check.
Just paragraph 4.4 of your summary. Could you expand a bit about what you mean by simulating the sun and environment?
Okay, so with each visual simulation, the time of day is basically replicated in 3D. So we position a virtual sun and virtual sky into the scene to basically simulate the shadows cast by the 3D model. And that's using Autodesk software.
So what difference does variable weather have from summer and winter? What differences in light levels, cloud cover? And
In terms of different light levels we've got, we do have two different settings for the overall sky setting. Basically, we pick
either option, so it's either going to be a sunny day or it's going to be an overcast day in the 3D SNAP software. That changes the light levels slightly, but it's not something that I would say is visually very different at all.
I'm not sure how to phrase this next question. I'll stagger through it. The effect of converting a 3D experience, visual experience, into 2D, does it tend to diminish any aspects of what you're looking at?
Well, I would say, in terms of obviously a visual simulation, at the end of the day, it is a photograph. We can't replicate exactly how you're going to experience the site or see it from that particular position. We always recommend, obviously, visiting the site as well.
See the thing. So this is what, before it's built, so this is why you can.
Yeah. So yeah, no, visual simulation, it is a photograph. There's a lot of other aspects which we can't cover, such as movement or variable light conditions and changing. So at the end of the day, it's a snapshot in time of that particular viewpoint.
First, we didn't understand the yellow bits, but I'm having reread the evidence.
I asked about the yellow bits a
few times. Especially the yellow mesh. Perhaps you could just explain it.
Okay, yeah. So the yellow mesh that you see there is basically it's a 3D model of the terrain surface. So that's using the LiDAR data. So basically, that's a bunch of points that we've triangulated and created a 3D mesh of the surface. That is also used to help us align the photograph. Due to the nature of the site, it's very up and down, which is great for our simulations, and it gives us a lot of opportunity to pick out features which we can then align to.
A representative sample of that would have been probably just as helpful as doing it to all of them. Because, I mean, I understand it's just it's a technique to help you to align to the photograph.
Yes, yeah, it's just a technique.
Architecture witnesses are clearly set out in the statement, which I'm referring to, the joint witness statement that summarises our caucusing session that was the date of that statement, the 24th of August. The first point, suitability of the land for the zone. There is agreement about the classification of the subject land as falling within an outstanding natural landscape. Given this classification, MELSOP is of the opinion that it is not suitable to accommodate the activity by the QPSZ. I remain of the opinion that Queenstown Park is a distinctive place but exhibits a number of characteristics that make it particularly well suited to accommodate the rural-based tourism and recreation hub that is enabled by the zone. In particular, the land's spectacular landscape setting, its relative isolation while being proximate to the urban environment, the gentle north-facing topography of the lower terraces, the existing and potential recreation opportunities in the area, make it well suited to enable a range of interrelated activities that are mutually supportive to enable the sustainable management of the rural land. Section 3, amendments to the zone provisions. In response to a number of points raised in Ms. Milsock's rebuttal evidence and discussions in the joint witness caucus in the meeting, I've recommended a number of changes to the provisions to ensure that development within the activity areas appropriately responds to the landscape values and integrates with its wider setting, and to ensure that a rural character is maintained. These changes include additional matters for discretion for CDP consents, additional matters for discretion for subdivision, additional matters over which control is reserved for glamping, and including pedestrian bridges in the activity category with jetties and wharves. These recommended changes have been incorporated in the updated zone provisions, including the Dave Sargent supplementary evidence as it came to play. Turning to requirements for CDPs. Ms. Milsock is of the opinion that it would be preferable for CDPs to be required for all activity areas. I do not agree. The revised provisions require CDPs for RV3, RV4 and RR3. In my opinion, the complexity of these areas in terms of topography and in the case of the RV3 and RV4, the activity mix and resulting development pattern enabled, mean that they would benefit from a CDP to ensure an integrated approach to the broad planning and structuring of these areas. The other activity areas are either much smaller or more straightforward in terms of their topography and anticipated activity mix. I remain of the opinion that the effects of development for these activity areas can be appropriately managed through the subdivision process. To require a CDP first would result in a duplication of process that would be of little benefit. However, as I've noted above, I have recommended additional matters for discretion for subdivision in Rule 27.5.7 to ensure development appropriately responds to the landscape values and integrates with its wider setting and maintains a rural character. Turning to rural character. In my opinion, in the context of the expansive and dramatic rural setting, the built environment enabled by the zone will be subservient to and its character strongly influenced by its setting. The configuration of discrete activity areas that have been determined in response to the characteristics of the land, together with the requirement for CDPs, the matters of discretion for subdivision, and the matters for control for new buildings, in my opinion, will ensure that the village and associated rural residential plots will have a rural rather than an urban character. In conclusion, having considered the rebuttal evidence in myself, Milsock, and participated in expert caucusing, I remain of the opinion that the characteristic of Queenstown Park make it particularly well suited to accommodate the rural-based tourism and recreation hub that is envisaged by the zone. In my opinion, the proposed zone is a rural zone that will sit comfortably and be subservient to a spectacular landscape setting. Happy to answer any questions.
I'm looking up your presentation sheet rather than the
second. Okay, cool. So if I take you to, I mean, let's get your conclusions in paragraph 2.1b. Could you please explain to me how building something that you wouldn't normally expect in a rural area can reinforce the rural character?
Well, I don't know what you mean by saying that you wouldn't normally expect in a rural area.
I wouldn't expect the village, the intensity of the village. How does that reinforce the rural character?
Well, I don't think it's unexpected to find villages within rural environments. So that's a starting point. I think that you can that rural village, the villages are an anticipated part of the rural environment. And then the character of that, whether it's urban or rural, comes down to a number of factors. And I've outlined those in my evidence, including the scale and intensity of development, its containment, its area of containment in relation to its surrounding context, so how it relates to that surrounding rural environment, and then down to the design of streets, buildings, site development, and areas.
Well, you've talked a great deal about rural environments. You haven't talked very much at all about outstanding natural landscapes. Have you? As villages something that would not be expected? Would be provided for an outstanding landscape?
Sorry, would not be expected? Did you say?
Would they? You said villages are expected feature a rural environment. Are they also commonly to be expected in an outstanding natural landscape?
I would say commonly, but I think they can be expected to be found in outstanding natural landscapes, yes.
Paragraph 4.4, this is the point I discussed quite extensively with Mr. Brown yesterday. When you say the Kawara River creates a clear edge and separation from the urban environment, so what's the point of that statement?
I think that's describing a differentiation between the pattern of development that would be enabled by this zone and the established pattern of development on the northern banks of the river, and the fact that there is a clear edge creating a separation to those two.
Mr. Brown is rather talking about the connection between the two, the integration through context, so I'm confused.
In my opinion, it is an edge. It's a clear differentiation. It's a clear edge to the urban environment.
So Lake Hayes is the urban environment, and RV3 is the rural environment.
That's right.
Because of the separation.
No, because of the environment that RV3 sits within. So sitting within that wider station and sitting at the foot of the mountains rising steeply. As the backdrop and the limited extent of the development area. Saying it won't be read or be perceived as an extension of the residential environment, so there'll be a clear distinction of break between that residential environment, which I think is clearly an urban part of urban Queenstown, and then the river creates a break to that, and then the village is contained and it's the containment of the rural environment around it that is an important aspect of its rural character.
Just to add to that, I saw the bridges, the transport and the gondola actually linking them. So how can there be separation and connection at the same time?
They physically link them, so they give you a connection so that you can physically access them. But in terms of the perception of the actual physical form of development, there's a clear differentiation and break between the two.
Now this issue of urban versus rural character, which you're firmly of the view that RV3, for example, with its intense development and three-story buildings, large three-story buildings, can be categorised as rural.
Given the scale of the surrounding topography and the limited area and density control, not density, sorry, the coverage control, yes, I do. Yeah. So, for example, I'm going to give you another example of large buildings within rural environments. for, so if you look at the Hermitage in Mount Cook, which is a very large building,
yes.
It'd be much larger than the buildings we're looking at within this zone, the Bicromis zone. But it definitely still reads as being part of, I wouldn't call that rural, it's more of a remote alpine environment.
It is what it is.
But it's very subservient to that environment and it's easily contained within that environment.
Can we just ask on this question, because we've got in paragraph 6.5 that they essentially say RB3 will be a small scale village. But how many people will have to come back?
That will depend on the mixture of activities that end up being the combination of different uses.
Well, that could be the forecast. You must have some of them, haven't you? Done an assessment of it.
Well, it depends if it has a focus on accommodation or if it has a focus on different rural tourism activities. So I don't have a clear indication.
Well, what does it have a focus on accommodation?
I couldn't tell you.
What would make you uncomfortable about RB3?
In terms of the scale of development? Yes. In terms of the scale of buildings or the activity mix? Or
let's talk about the physical nature of it. And that, to some extent, is dependent on the activity mix. But yeah. Would a couple of Hermitage scale, of course, we've only got a 3-storey height limit, so that's impossible. But
yeah, that's right.
But in terms of equivalent bulk achieved through length and other dimensions?
I think that would, yeah, so the scale, if it was overly bulky and if the visual mass of a building wasn't broken down and if it exceeded, if it went up further on the height. So for example, if the height limit across that zone were 12 metres, I wouldn't feel comfortable with that.
What is the height limit? When we're talking 3 stories, it must be including off of that.
So it's 8 metres up to 12 metres.
16
metres. Yeah, 12 up to 16. So the upper level, the upper terrace of RB3 is at a height limit of 8 metres. That's a permitted height limit, and then up to 12 metres for discretion.
And the gondola towers are up to 23
metres. In a single point.
So what would you say about that? What would make you uncomfortable?
If across that whole zone of RB3, if the height limit were at 12 metres and an associated building mass without any control over the form of buildings.
So the first 12 metre building will be okay, but beyond that, it's starting to, you wouldn't want every building to be 12 metres, is that what you're saying?
I'm not necessarily saying the first building. So the purpose for having the DCP process is to allow an overall structuring of the village to ensure that the distribution of those elements is appropriate.
You have to explain that to me because I didn't understand the DCP to be particular about the buildings.
It's the CDP.
Sorry,
it's about the
CDP, the comprehensive plan.
Distribution of heights, one of the factors that you look at. The new CDP.
The CDP will actually
provide
a distribution of.
That's what I anticipate in terms of development areas. You need to look at where your maximum height, where your 12 metre might be, and give an indication of how that height's going to be distributed for the various reasons.
I took it as being a sort of a layout, but I suppose I assumed that was a 2D layout rather than a 3D one.
Only the distribution of height would give you that 3D. Okay. It would be 2D, but that information.
That is in the concept.
So this got to mention that, and there's evidence what you mean by distribution of height, and it's a fair question. What we anticipate is within development areas with the pods, you'd be looking at where you might position a taller building, give an indication of how you distribute your height, so it wasn't all one height, there was variation, things like that.
And ensuring that that's located in an appropriate location where it actually helps define potentially a village square, a village centre, is that additional height can be a beneficial thing.
But on the other hand, while it says that in CP2, rule 44.5.5.4, or 3.3.4, I think we see anywhere on the standing one that says on the CDP.
Well,
if that's not a matter of discretion.
You can do that. Well, what I would say about that from an assessment perspective is that if you put in a CDP or a series of applications with uniform maximum height, I'd be very surprised if you get consent given all the other directors in terms of character, level, and scale, and all of those assessment criteria. Sorry, it's probably matter, more a matter of discussion too.
Yeah.
But no, I take your point. It's good. I understand the tech, if there's a 10% of rules.
Mm.
Everyone, I guess, would. Applicants may seek to maximise the development envelope, but what we would say is there's a strong pushback from these provisions about that.
I would have thought May is not quite for me.
You may be right about that.
There's a more positive reason than that.
No, just, I mean, as I said earlier, this interaction is helpful for us.
Mm.
Remember these provisions a lot, being that on itself.
Sorry, that's a bit confusing, isn't it? The way this is structured, the way this whole proposal has been structured, the rural residential aspect is separate from the gondola and not dependent on it. So if the gondola didn't proceed, we could still get 90 rural residential drones spread out over the various points. I'm trying to find out from various witnesses how that figure of 90 is derived.
I don't know how to figure out 90.
Okay, so comment on it. Is it an appropriate upper limit?
Yes, I think it is, yes.
Why do you say that?
Because within the other controls over the rural residential activity, which limits minimum lot size to 4,000 square metres, and the areas for each of those development pods, they can be accommodated within those development areas. With additional flexibility depending on whether residential sites are created within the rural visitor zones as well. So they can be accommodated and achieve the outcome sought within those areas.
Now, if this was not a comprehensive to the tourism visitor, if it wasn't the proposal that it is, and it was just a proposal for a bunch of rural resident pods in that location, would you be supportive of it?
Not conditionally. Less supportive of it, but it still does provide a different living opportunity within the district. So it provides, and in a location that's relatively discreet, so it still has the benefits, many of the benefits I've described of this area being proximate to the urban area of Queenstown, but having a relatively remote feel to it and character, being north-facing, having the amenities provided by the river. So it provides many benefits for rural residential living. I think there's a lot more benefit with the combination of the other aspects.
Why do you say that? I mean, asking you as a landscape professional,
yes.
not a salesperson for rural residential development.
No, but I'm saying, that's why I say I'd be less supportive of it. But there are still, in terms of looking for locations to appropriately provide, and that's where I'm not so clear on the other locations within the district and the capacity and the provision for rural residential opportunities. So if there's a demand seen or is a need to accommodate activity within the district, this I think is an appropriate location for it.
I suppose what I'm getting at is the rural residential justifiable really in an overall judgment sense in order to enable the other activities.
I can't name that call on that.
Okay.
On the justification on
that. Okay. Thank you.
Just one. us what the areas are of the three lower tiers and upper tiers?
Sure.
So the RB3 lower terrace is 15.1 hectares, and the RB3 upper terrace is 12.4 hectares. The particular values of the value now in Queenstown Lakes District, 96.97% of the district is value now, and the descriptions in the plan do not distinguish one RML from another. So, they're remarkable to ONL to form a given time. What are the ONL values?
I think we had some discussion around this in our caucus in the meeting, was that even within that, if you describe it as the remarkables ONL, there are differences in values within that ONL, or different characteristics in that contribute to the values of the ONL. So probably the scale of the landscape in terms of vertically and horizontally in terms of amount of range particularly contribute to its values, the overall scale, the texture of the landscape, so as landforms, the different landforms within that landscape. So you have that craggy mountain face that we're looking across to now, and then moving around to the northern face being a more sort of rounded uniform, and then coming down to the river terraces, so the differential, and then down to the river corridor itself.
Any other?
The vegetation patterns. So you've got a pasture environment around the margins of the river and on those lower river terraces, leading to the more craggy escarpments and the vegetation associated with that at the upper levels. And then there's probably the climatic changes too, so the differences that are perceived, and they vary throughout the seasons as well, obviously. One of the distinctive features when we look across at the face of the remarkable side is the catching of snow around it, so the different snow patterns, and then we go to the basin area where the snow catches, and then obviously the recreational uses of the snow with that being a sea field. So that's different.
Okay, so those are the ONL values, and when the assessment criteria that were added, which refer to responding to the landscape pattern, what is meant by the landscape pattern?
So in the areas where those development pods are, so looking at particularly around the topography, so for example in RR3, there's quite an undulating hillocks topography, and there are sort of smaller escarpments and terraces in some of the areas, so they contribute to the landscape patterning. And then of course the two main river valleys that come down and that separate development areas, so the rest of the island creek.
When an assessment is done of a restricted discretionary activity for a CDP for the subdivision, and you're looking at the distribution of height, how would that assessment take into account landscape patterns?
So in the RB3 zone, there's obviously quite a major escarpment that separates the two terrace areas. So you might look at firstly how that is located in relation to the escarpment, and secondly how it's located in relation to the edges of the activity area, so the front edge or the side edges that drop away, for example, to the Rasterspoon corridor, so keeping the height more centrally located within the development area, I would anticipate.
Could you make assessment criteria that were that clear?
Yes. Yep. Yes. I think the difficulty here is the way the plan's been drafted is it sets out matters for discretion rather than detailed assessment criteria.
Or the policy, exactly.
The assessment criteria being incorporated
into policies
as much as possible.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm. And so those policies, that if looking for the relevant policy to then set in, what would it set, which one is, or which one does that be?
So again, it's not as directed as that. So, so policy 44211, to achieve a coordinated activity mix and built environment that responds to the underlying landscape patterns.
Is that a policy?
That is a policy, yes.
Oh, it is a policy.
Sorry.
What's the action? What's the action?
Certainly there's an outcome, but the action is coordination.
An outcome is an objective.
Yes, but you've got the action is the coordination of those activities. I think that's all you can draw from that, is that activities need to speak to one another, that they're coordinated, they're not isolated. I understand that you want the outcome and then how you achieve it. So
yeah, that's what the act requires, actually.
Yeah, it does, although there's plenty of case law that gives us significant breadth on what you can write in policy.
Mm.
Having said that, you want as much clarity as you can with reasonable flexibility and interpretation as well. But that's what I'd say to the action is there, is the coordination of the activity mix.
So the other two policies that I think are relevant are policy 44213.
Yes, I'm just looking at that.
And 44216. And then,
I'm just leaning the landscape to see. That refers to landscape values. So in that case, are we talking about the values of the ONL, or are we talking about landscape values in terms of the patterns that are spot on in this RV pool?
I think both, actually. So it's the landscape values in the widest sense. So those are the values that are local in relation to that specific development area, and there are the values of the wider, of the overall ONL.
Well, in fact, the policy is limited to the boundaries of Queenstown Park, isn't it?
Yes, it is because
it's in the zone, isn't it? Okay.
Well,
it's not talking about the wider ONL,
because it's...
But it's part of the ONL. The zone is part of the ONL. So an ONL doesn't stop and start at zone boundaries.
ONL doesn't, but this policy does.
What the policy says is that it creates its own outcome, so it contains its own objective. Mm-hmm. And the own objective is the values and opportunities within Queenstown Park.
It's the and between landscape values and opportunities. So the opportunities within that I see within landscape values are also then framed as within. I don't think that's the intention of the policy.
Well, it shouldn't even have the objective in the policy, because it doesn't reflect the objective at the beginning.
Well,
unless it's a 2 meter narrow.
I think it's attempting to get focused on the objective, but the intention is not to look narrowly and make that part of your use is the skin also understand that. The point, and just the point made was right before Mr. Sargent, in terms of action, that's the implementation you're looking at.
Yes.
In terms of the concept.
Can I just have one last question? Could you write down Mr. Wolfstone's evidence where he says that the use of low impact design and other methods of stormwater will influence the form of the development? And I wanted to know from you what that might do and if it would in any way have an effect, positive or adverse, on the O&L values and then the landscape patterns.
It's more relevant to the landscape patterns than to the O&L values because it will come down to that detailed level at a local within the. I think it could, depending on how it's implemented and how so it comes down to a design aspect, I think it could have a positive impact on those values.
Thank you, Chair.
I have no further questions.
Thank you, sir. I have an opinion here where we're moving at a more rapid speed than I thought we might.
Yes, we're moving very quickly on this here, is it?
No, no, it's
all the witnesses here today. We might come up.
Well, I'm going to make some calls possibly to see if we can get anyone this afternoon who might not just travel. Not that opinion now, do you want to have a copy?
No, we'll have the copy at 3:30. Okay. I'll deal with Mr. Peter in that position.
And if I can go, that doesn't give me problems if I go to the witnesses, you know, in terms of you willing to pre-read anything.
We're ready.
By now. So the QPSZ will enable the installation of a gondola from Remarkables Park to the Remarkables Ski Field and the development of discrete areas of Queenstown Park for rural residential and rural visitor activities. The gondola will provide alternative access to the top of the Remarkables and also to the development pods and potentially to Lake Hayes Estate. The QPSZ also contemplates access to Queenstown Park by road, by ferries, and via trails for pedestrians and cyclists. Turning to the transportation objectives and policies, the QPSZ is considered to be generally consistent with the objectives and policies in the proposed district plan relating to transportation. There is an emphasis on reduced environmental effects through efficient operation of transport infrastructure and increased use of modes other than private motor vehicles. The gondola is the prime element in terms of reducing effects because it will substantially reduce the amount of vehicle traffic and car parking associated with travel up the Remarkables. The gondola will also reduce the traffic and parking associated with the development of pods facilitated by the QPSZ, as will access to these sites provided by trails, including new bridges across the river, and jet boat ferries. As a result, the Queenstown Park Access Road, which will largely follow the existing farm track along the south side of the Kawarra River, will not need to accommodate a high level of traffic and can be constructed to a lower standard. That will encourage more use of the alternative modes and reduce the effects of the construction as described by other witnesses. Council report. The initial council report on the QPSZ transportation expressed concern about a lack of information regarding transportation matters, particularly the effect of the traffic generated by the development pods. My statement of evidence and that of Mr. Sargent addressed these concerns, and Mr. Mander in his rebuttal evidence stated, I do not oppose the rezoning on traffic and transportation grounds, provided the NZ Transport Agency is notified of any applications affecting the site, and that, I should say that, the proposed rule 4452 is recommended to be accepted. Rule 4452 states that the Boyd Road State Highway intersection is to be upgraded prior to any residential or visitor accommodation within the rural visitor or rural residential activity areas. Otherwise, such accommodation will be non-compliant activity. Roads are part of the comprehensive development and plan consent, which is a restricted discretionary activity. Rule 4462 states that notice shall be served on persons considered to be adversely affected when consent for a restricted discretionary activity is sought. I would expect that NZTA would therefore be served notice of the upgrade of the Boyd Road State Highway intersection. Conclusions are concluded as follows. The proposed corridor through the QPSZ to enable the installation of a gondola will result in reduced transportation effects associated with the movement of people up and down the Remarkables. The development facilitated by the proposed rural visitor and rural residential pods within the QPSZ can be provided with access via the gondola and or via jet boat ferries and or via walking and cycling trails, reducing the number of motor vehicles using the access road. Car parking and drop-off facilities for private and public transport can be provided at the Remarkables Park Town Centre and the Lake Hayes Estate gondola stations, reducing the need for parking at the Remarkables Ski Field and at the rural residential and visitor pods in the QPSZ. And the gondola can also provide an effective alternative form of public transport, particularly for commuters and school children travelling between Remarkables Park and Lake Hayes Estate. Overall, I have concluded that the QPSZ is generally consistent with the transportation objectives and policies of the PDP and the regional planning documents. Furthermore, I expect that the transportation infrastructure for the development enabled by the zone can be designed to be compatible with the transportation-related rules in the PDP, with the appropriate design codes, and with the projects included in the respective transport strategies. Accordingly, the zone can be supported from a transportation perspective.
So, intersection with the State Highway, Boyd Road. The word in the rule simply says that the road intersection should be upgraded. It doesn't say anything about the standard of that upgrade or the extent of it, which the cynic in me then says, well, perhaps you do a little bit on your own, although Queenstown Park does something to it on its own land, and that would satisfy that rule. Would it make preferable to have something in the rule to the effect to the satisfaction of NZTA?
Yeah, we could easily do that, but I think sort of beyond the planning horizon, if you like, to do anything on the State Highway, you have to get technical approval from NZTA.
It's really a matter of definition of what amounts to an upgrade to the intersection, and does it, would upgrading Boyd Road in the vicinity of the intersection without actually reaching the NZTA land satisfy that rule? It's something really technical to you.
Certainly not the intention.
No. I was just saying, would it be better to put in a clause like for the satisfaction of the NZTA?
No, I
It's going to have to happen anyway. So
yes, I mean, it's going to be done properly, certainly, going to have to, because they have total control.
Absolutely.
They're going to have to.
Yeah.
I don't think you can resist those rates.
It does say the end decision, though. It doesn't, it doesn't just say void road.
Yeah, I just thought that rule was a bit vague.
Right.
Can I?
I mean, obviously at this stage we haven't decided exactly what that design would look like. It's reasonably complicated. There's some visibility issues, etc. But it's a fairly standard intersection form around New Zealand, where NZTA and other roading authorities have modified them to get away from those tangential roads that come into the side roads.
Yeah, that's all right. Now, car parking at Lake Hose Estate, I understand that from your evidence in chief that you really anticipate that to be on the road reserve?
Yes, that's where it has been indicated, and there have been discussions with the council about that, and I haven't been a direct party to those conversations, but I understand that the council has said, without wanting to commit themselves, that they're sympathetic to that idea.
Have you done any calculations of the volume of car parking that might happen there?
Yes, we've looked at the possibility of getting 140 car parking spaces in there. And with the drop-off area as well, a cul-de-sac head at the end of the reserve. So that would allow for people to be dropped off and then park their cars, minus their ski gear, and it would allow for taxis and minibuses.
So those 140 spaces would just extend back up the hill?
Not up the hill, but back towards Lake Hose Estate.
Well, I mean, the road does slope down a bit.
Oh, yes, yes. So, in the context of that.
The road is wide enough for parking on both sides there?
Yes.
And lots of people moving around?
Yes. We have actually done a schematic design for it.
I've found it, I haven't visited the site, it seems a bit surprising, but if you've done enough work.
And if you've got a design in my bridge case, if you'd like to see that.
It might be interesting. there's a disagreement. I think you say in your evidence in chief, don't you, that the road may not have to be sealed? And whereas Mr. Ralston this morning said it definitely would be sealed, so can you clarify that?
Sorry, if I can just clarify Mr. Ralston's evidence that he's here. I think if you get to a certain width, the design standards would like it to be sealed, and he's following the standards, but Mr. Penny answers, but he's talking about how you might discourage use, and any one of those widths could be the outcome. There's no commitment to sealing it. The preference is to not, but then it's how.
Well, we're talking about, I mean, we've had quite a lot of discussion about this, obviously. And being a private road, it could be done through the standard that the owner decides, of course. And the logic behind that is to try and discourage people using cars and to use the gondola. But it's accepted that it might be necessary to seal the road at a certain level of development.
So
you wouldn't want to.
Yeah, you described that use of the gondola. Now, I bought a rural residential property. I'm pretending that I live there. And I'm staying there with my family and a couple of guests. Is it? I want to go to town for the day and do something else. Is it really realistic to think that we'll catch a shuttle to the gondola station and then catch a gondola to Remarkable Park and then catch a bus to Queenstown, a process which might take quite a long time, but surely people like that are going to hop in their car.
They may well do.
I mean, apart from the cost and the time involved.
Yeah. Well, of course, the people who are regularly using the gondola will get concession tickets. I mean, that's because generally they'll be backloading the gondola, so from an operational point of view, it's quite nice to have those people involved. But you're right. I mean, if you're going to another ski field, for example, then you're likely to take your car. But if you're going out to a restaurant or a Remarkable Park, you don't have to drive home.
very attractive if you want to do your shopping. Presumably, if you're there on holiday or you're not buying a massive amount at the supermarket, you can carry that back on the gondola with you. So there's a lot of activities that go into your normal traffic generation estimation that involve trips that could be done on the gondola. I mean, if you happen to have school-aged kids, they'll definitely have to use the gondola. Because the gondola station is right next to the high school. Mm-hmm. We're certainly anticipating that people in the rural residential units will use their cars to a certain extent. And I've worked on a worst-case basis that they'd be creating 8 vehicle movements per day. In my calculations.
8 vehicles per household?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a reasonably high. Or even the conventional rural residential mode, isn't it?
Well, it's one that's used throughout the district here.
We've got other districts as well.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not aware that Selwyn District used it, for example. Yeah. They go through somebody with it.
Yes. And I believe that would be that's very high.
Yes, it is.
Because of the gondola. Because of the trails. You're familiar with Christchurch. I mean, we know for a fact that if you live in one of the inner suburbs, you'll drive home and you'll get back in your car later on and go to the supermarket. But if you live on the hills, you don't do that.
Yes, if you live way out there, you're even less likely to do
that. Exactly. It's way out there in some regards, but it's not way out there in other regards, of course, because it's immediately across the river from the urban area.
So what you've said is that you have assumed quite a high traffic generation rate from the rural residential part.
Yes. Well, I needed to do that because Mr. Mander had expressed some concern about intersections of the...
That was sort of a worst case for the intersection. Road widths and formation, and particularly the intersection. That's what you used for...
Exactly. I mean, the issue really is that in the future, the traffic volume on State Highway 6 will go up significantly if Jack's Point development and the other developments to the south of Queenstown are completed. So it won't necessarily be as easy as it is at the moment to turn off and on to State Highway 6.
It's about 4,000 vehicles a day at the moment, yeah. I think.
Yeah. Expect that to be quite a bit higher in the future.
I'm a bit intrigued with the thought of people biking the town along the trails too.
Well, that'd be pretty attractive with the bridges in the right place.
Would the cycling be more of a recreational activity? It takes so jolly long if you're actually going somewhere. Isn't that something in its own right?
Well, yes, but if you're a recreational cyclist, then you can combine that with popping in to have a meal or something else in the Remarkables Park. I mean, a lot of people do cycle and end up socialising afterwards, or simply going in to do some sort of errand in the nearest shopping centre. I would have thought it's quite attractive. And that all assumes, of course, that the bridges are put in, because at the moment you have to go right up to the old bridge at the falls to get into Remarkables Park, for example.
Well, you said at paragraph 64 that the residential pods, or you don't really need to look it up, but you said the residential pods will be within convenient reach of Remarkables Park via the gondola, the ferry, or the new access road to a lesser extent. Say that, this is something I'm exploring with lots of witnesses, say the gondola didn't happen and the rural residential pods did. There's no problem. They'd be entirely dependent on the road, and that's workable.
Well, other than maybe the trails and, yeah, maybe and some new bridges, for example, yeah. Or, and maybe the ferries would happen, some of the ferries would happen in that situation, I guess. But certainly in terms of effects, the critical effect, as I see it, which is the intersection of the access road and the state highway, the traffic volume is still going to be lower because I've taken the full traffic generation you could expect. In fact, as we discussed before, probably higher than you might expect, even with just the rural residential. And obviously that's going to be less, therefore the effect at that intersection is likely to be less.
Just a point of clarification on your table one, where you set out traffic volumes. There's State Highway 6 at Lady Mile. Whereabouts is that exactly?
That's effectively the Shotover Bridge.
Right. That's what it comes to, so that's...
Yeah. Oh, no, wait a minute, no, that can't be right, actually. No, it must be immediately west of Glenda Drive or the new Eastern Arterial Road, that's why it's gone down.
Yes, that's what I was wondering, so yeah. It's in that...
Yeah.
It's actually, yes.
Yeah.
What is...
Lady's Mile is, of course, you know, a much longer stretch, I was a bit...
Yeah,
bit,
Lady's
Mile. It's a bit loose, it goes a long way.
Lady's Mile is on the other side of the river.
Yeah.
Is the, Franklin's Flats area.
Yeah, no. Yeah. It extends all the way from the case, basically, up to the roundabout, BB roundabout.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Just,
I toyed with the idea, but we're not talking huge volumes. We thought initially that it might be quite substantial, but when we thought about the catchment of people who want to go there rather than go to Remarkables Park, we didn't think it was quite so many. And people, again, tend to socialise after a ski day. And so they're more likely to want to park at Remarkables Park, where the restaurants and cafes and things are.
Well, visitors might, what about locals? I'm just thinking,
yes.
Myself, for instance, coming from Wanaka, they're a lot quicker to go to Bay Caves.
Yes, well, no, that's quite true. Quite true.
Yeah. Same people living in Arica.
Yeah. It's been quite difficult assessing that. The reason we didn't look at it, we thought that the critical aspect would be the state highway intersection. And I think measures at the moment are rapidly pushing towards a new roundabout for the access into Lake Hayes Estate on the state highway. And that will largely resolve that issue. I don't know if that's 100% confirmed, but certainly with the rest home going in there off that road, there's expected to be some more traffic, and of course development continues in that area. And I also understand there's a certain amount of threat on the other side of the road as well in terms of possible development. I don't know where that's got to.
Yeah.
One of the state housing areas. There's like official housing areas.
So Rob Greenaway was delayed this morning. He'll land at 1:35 or 1:35. And then John Ballinghall might be here, so we can get him on today as well, rather than tomorrow. But it would mean.
So we're through the group of two.
I'm sorry about that, sir. We're trying to predict how things would run. I'm short today. They're right yesterday. Not too good today. So we're trying to get John Ballinghall in, so we've got a full afternoon.
Thank you, sir. We'll do it for two. Thank you.